4 for the Eagles here. Murphy and shotgun. Here's the snap. He rolls left. He throws.
Welcome to episode 21 of the WZBC Sports Podcast. Very special episode today. We're here with a very special guest who we'll introduce in a moment. I'm Anthony Iotti. I'm here with Casey Haig, the two co-directors of WZBC Sports this year. And to introduce our guest, very distinguished alum of Boston College and of WZBC Sports, Joe Tessitore. Joe, thank you for being here.
It's great to be here. Has much changed at ZBC in the last 25 to 30 years? What should I be up to speed on?
Well, I think a lot has changed. Yeah. I mean, we'll certainly get into it. That's one of the segments, but I think you've already noticed our branding with the sweatshirt.
It's wonderful. I mean, you got sweatshirts and shirts. I mean, right away, it's a huge upgrade.
Yeah, and hey, I can tell you this podcast was not in existence 20 years ago.
No, definitely not.
So that's certainly something new. So just a little bit of background on Joe for those who may be less familiar with him. Boston College Carroll School of Management, class of 1993.
Yes.
Studied marketing, correct?
Yes. Why did I do that? Why did I put myself through that hell to do that, to then have this career? I just could have hung out, basically, and talked sports, right?
That's right. But, yeah. I mean, who knows? If this career hadn't worked out, right. That would have been...
Who are your sources on this, by the way? You didn't call my wife, did you?
I
don't have anything to worry about here, do I?
I think you're okay.
Okay.
There are, you know, maybe one or two things that I found in articles about you skipping class. We'll get there.
It must be Boog Shambi was quoted there. Yeah.
We'll get there. Anyway, Boog Shambi, Bob Ostrowski, notable classmates of yours.
Yes, that's right. Chris O'Donnell, a classmate of mine. I took marketing classes with Chris. Amy Poehler was a very good friend of mine while I was here as well.
Wow. It's a really star-studded class. So, you know, worked your way up through the ranks in sports media, went through Dallas, Albany, Hartford, and now you've been with ESPN since 2002.
Many years at ESPN.
So I think where we want to start is with your Boston College days.
Mm-hmm.
So just originally, you know, as a 17, 18-year-old senior in high school, what brought you to BC as a whole?
Well, I come from a BC family, and, you know, listen, typical Italian-American Catholic student-athlete, went to Christian Brothers Academy in upstate New York, and, you know, back then, I would tell you, in terms of a target demographic of the 70s and 80s to late 80s when I came here, that would be your typical BC kid, right? So I had family that had gone to BC. We were BC sports fans. Family that was tailgating out here going back to the 70s. And then, of course, you know, I was one of the guys. I could tell you where I was sitting, who I was with, what I was doing when Flutie threw the pass. And it was a very short list of the schools that interested me. It was, I will apply early to BC, and if I get in, I'm going, and then I'll deal with everything after the fact. But... I think I was typical of a lot of guys from my generation and my background that landed at a school like this.
Well, obviously a lot of us who started at WZBC Sports didn't even know we wanted to do sports radio when we first entered. We found it on a win maybe at like the student activities fair. How did you get involved with WZBC? And you can kind of explain how your experience was with college radio here at BC.
Sure, because, you know, it's a good question, Casey, because obviously I was in the School of Management. And I didn't know I was going to end up having a broadcasting career, but I did know that I wanted to stay passionately close, especially to football. Football was my whole life. I love football no end. And when I was in high school, I suffered a Joe Theismann-esque catastrophic football injury that required 3 surgeries. So I had to have my left ankle reconstructed. And I knew that, listen, I'm going to go there, and from day one, before I even take a class, let me get involved in the student radio and the broadcasting of football, be around the team, and then quickly develop that relationship to the point where Jack Bicknell was the head coach back then. And I can remember Coach Bicknell and assistant coaches even being very welcoming of getting to know me and saying, come around, practice all you want. You're a football guy. Soak it all in, enjoy it. So I would go to my classes and then come out and watch practice and be able to interact with players and coaches and take it in and just still consume football to no end, broadcast the games while going about my studies. So It was great. I can remember sitting in this stadium where we are right now, and I can remember being with Jason Garrett's dad, who was a scout at the time, and he would come and scout BC, and guys like that, or different NFL scouts coming through, or former coaches coming through, and assistant coaches, and just really almost getting my undergraduate degree in football to a certain extent. And then what was also nice is that one of my high school buddies and a very dear friend was the starting running back at BC. So that was nice to have, you know, Chucky Dukes here and some dear friends on the team.
Yeah, I'm sure that access to the team and to the practice really helped out.
So that was how I initially got involved, was just staying close to the game. And then I loved ZBC. We had a one-hour sports call-in show. I think it was on Mondays, if I recall. Okay. Doing the games was incredible, traveling around, and we had some fundraising where we were able to travel and do that. And then the group of guys who were in my class and doing the games with me became just such close, dear friends to this day. And two of them are my colleagues at ESPN, right, which is incredible. Wishusen's been at ESPN for some years now, and Shambi's been there. But you know, we would just like you guys sitting in this room with me right now. That was us. You know, we were doing games together, and we were hanging out. We didn't realize where it was going to. If you told me that there would be a day and age, and we passed this threshold many, many years ago, where Bob Wischusen would be tossing to me on national television, you know, he would be wrapping up a game and saying, all right, let's get to, you know, the game now, and here's Joe Tessitore with that. I mean, that we couldn't have even, you know, dreamt that up. It just wasn't reality. But now it is, and we have a lot of fun with it.
That's absolutely true.
And we had a lot of fun back then.
Oh, I'm sure.
And we probably broke too many rules that you don't break at all.
Oh,
so.
Of course not.
Well, right. Speaking of breaking rules, I want to reference that article that I read in the Globe.
This
about
nothing
you.
Good can come of this. I don't even know where you're going.
True.
There was an article in the Globe stating that I didn't go to class.
Well, it says you might have skipped some classes to go watch practice.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, to watch practice. Yeah, if they were hitting pretty good and we were getting ready for Miami back then, yeah, I would do that. Yeah,
absolutely.
Shambi was missing classes for other reasons, though. There were remedies of hydration needed for him.
Now, did you catch? You caught the beginning of the Tom Coughlin era here, right?
I did. Yes. Yeah. Happened when I was, you know, in my last 2 years here, yes.
Yeah, and I'm a huge Giants fan, and
right.
Jake, who's in this room with us as well, is
his first head coaching job.
Do you have any interesting Coughlin stories from practice
yes.
that you're able to share?
Undoubtedly. I can tell you the first day he arrived on campus. Remember, the Giants had won the Super Bowl that year,
right?
And he was making recruiting calls from the locker room postgame. At the time, my roommate was Keith Miller, who was the starting wide receiver on the team. And I can remember Keith having to get up at 5 a.m. that first day that called, and they ran them into the ground. I mean,
surprised.
There was more puke. It was in the Plex back then. They showed up on a winter morning when Coughlin arrived on campus, and his first introduction to the team was early morning, and you will run, and you will run more. There was more puke on that Plex floor than on Bourbon Street. So yeah, I mean, and he, you're talking an all-time great of just hitting it just right, the right time in somebody's career, at the right place with the right kind of guys that would take to it with awesome enthusiasm and desire to be pushed to the next level. And then my senior year was the year when we got blasted out at Notre Dame when Lou Holtz called the fake punt. Lou Holtz, who went on to become one of my broadcast partners for many years, and more, you know, hundreds of hours of live TV with Lou Holtz after the fact, and games with Lou Holtz. And I've often reminded Lou of calling that fake punt out in South Bend when they were up by about 30-something points, and how Coughlin sat on that for a year.
Oh, I'm sure. He's still not over it.
We avenged it. My first year out of BC was the year that BC upset Notre Dame with David Gordon's, you know, sideways field goal attempt. And I had started my career at that point and was gathering sound bites, editing tape, writing sportscasts, and doing live shot interviews at the NBC affiliate in Dallas. Excuse me. And I scraped together, I was making no money, and I just put together what I could to get a plane ticket up to Chicago to drive out to watch that game, and was sitting right behind the the upright where that ball came through, and then made my way back to Dallas, and on New Year's night was assigned to go down to the Hyatt Regency downtown after Notre Dame had defeated Texas A&M earlier that day in the Cotton Bowl to do a taped interview with Lou Holtz as he was politicking. Back then, you did not have a BCS. There was no playoff. You had a politic for the poll to be named the national champion. As Lou Holtz sat there and was up one side of me and down the other for 20 minutes politicking, trying to spin it to have ND be named national champions, while I'm sitting there saying, how great is it that my former roommate was the guy that caught the pass that set up the field goal that's got you so bothered right now? That's what I was saying in my head. And I've reminded Lou of that as well through the years.
Sure.
Yeah, but Coughlin was awesome, absolutely awesome.
Yeah, and
still is, by the way, with for one reason that is very dear to me, and that is his support of the J Fund down in Florida. Jay McGillis, who we lost here while was in my class, he was a friend of mine who I met probably the first week of school here, living on upper campus. As you know, the spring game is named after him. There's a placard of him in the football locker room here. The scholarship given out is given in his honor and memory. And he was a dear friend to so many of us. And we lost Jay at the end of our junior year. It was devastating to lose him. But the fact that Coach Coughlin carries on his memory and does so to help others is very, very special to so many of us who went to school here in the late 80s and early 90s.
And speaking of going to school, and I guess speaking of also loss, we lost former president Father Monin recently. I don't
awesome
know
guy.
Do you have any experience with him?
Yes.
We all have one.
I walked across the stage and shook his hand and received my diploma. But really? Yes, but yes, he was he had a great presence to him while you were a student here. He was truly the embodiment of the spirit of BC. He was entrepreneurial. He was a guy who wanted to be excellent, and he wanted you to be excellent. He loved sports to no end. He was definitely a guy who you knew no matter what course of action he took in life, he was going to be excellent at it and be an awesome leader. And he had a huge presence, but you felt like you knew him. And I would tell you that when he passed, so many of my generation, friends, be it the email chains, the text chains, the social media, everybody was greatly touched. I don't care if you're my age of 46 through, you know, my cousins and uncles, folks who graduate here in the mid-70s. He impacted so many lives. I mean, I got in the car and drove up here to come to his services just to pay my respects and to pray. He is the embodiment of what this university stands on the bedrock that he put in the ground. And he's the most significant person in the history of this university, and in my eyes, it's not close. It's not close. BC had a fork in the road, and he took BC by the reins and propelled us to be a national elite university in every way. And we wouldn't be having this conversation without Don Monin. Wouldn't happen.
That's great insight and certainly a tremendous loss for the school. But sort of shifting gears here to your climb through the professional ranks in broadcasting.
Sure.
Talk about, you know, how difficult or maybe not difficult it was for you to work your way up. You started in Dallas, as I mentioned, to get all the way to ESPN. You know, what was that journey like?
In my era, through what is your era of broadcasting, the idea of somebody saying, I want to be on national TV and I want to have this as a rewarding career and be successful and, you know, I want to broadcast these games or do this, would be akin to just a generation of going saying, I want to go to Hollywood and be an actor. I mean, it's built for you to fail.
Yeah.
You're going to put your head down and you're going to probably have some moments of doubt, and you better really want it and be driven. And you can be very, very good, extremely hardworking, and still have no shot. So I am filled with gratitude and very appreciative and feel very blessed that I am in the position I am in, that I am able to have the rewards of it, and that so many of my brethren that we already discussed are as well, because the odds are stacked greatly against you. And it is not a normal next rung on a ladder career. It is not built the way our friends who are graduating from CSOM with an accounting degree will go work at one of the big four and then, you know, sit back and be partner in 10 years and 12 years after that this, or go off to their own. Yeah, it's not what it is. You're rolling the dice in life. Everybody and their brother at 17 or 18 years old says they want to work at ESPN and thinks they know more sports than you and thinks they're better on air than you and thinks their opinion's better than yours and thinks their presentation. Every guy in America thinks that he can do three things better than some other guy. Number one is coach football, play call better. That's a dumb play. Why would we do that? I would have done this.
We're all guilty of screaming that.
Number two is grill meats. I'm great on the grill. I make a great steak. I make a great burger. I'm good with ribs. Every guy thinks he can do that better than this. And the other one is broadcast a football game. When you watch a football game, you complain about the broadcast. Say, well, he doesn't know he's talking about it. And I work in one of those three. So, I'm very, very blessed. But the career path was, I was working in Dallas as an intern while I was still at BC. I used to get my 1976 Cutlass Supreme and drive down to Dallas, Texas. We didn't have cell phones back then. We didn't have navigation. I literally got in a car and started driving towards Texas. And I would do that on spring break and summer break, whenever I could, just to gain experience, and then work there out of school, hardly making any money, and then got a job as like the number three guy in upstate New York at the local CBS affiliate. Number two guy had some circumstances he had to move on. Number one guy went to go do Access Hollywood or Entertainment Tonight or one of those slap shows. Mm-hmm. And so I was on the air like 7 days a week at 23 years old. ESPN2 was just starting. They were interviewing young broadcasters. They brought me down at a young age. And while I was down there, the bigger local CBS of Southern New England, Channel 3, called over there, and ESPN kind of, angled for me to be right down the road doing the 6 and 11 o'clock news and the UConn, the Jim Calhoun show and Hartford Whalers hockey, and did that for until 2001, when ESPN then called up and said, hey, we want you to be a full-time play-by-play guy for us, which happened, I think, February of 02, early February of 02. That's when I started ESPN.
That's awesome.
It sounds simple. It wasn't that simple. It was, a lot of endless hours.
A lot of hard work. Yeah, and for people who are like us in sports radio, that's actually some great advice. Now, obviously, you've got to call some really high-profile games in some of your years with a lot of experience. What do you think for someone like Tony Romo, who's about to jump into it, how do you think that's going to be without any broadcasting experience?
It's not going to be easy, but he's working with a phenomenal director, producer, well-resourced. He's working with the best. He's working with a group that will give him the ability to prep all summer to get some reps. But it is not easy. First of all, you have to be good with the mechanics in the booth and the dance of it all. Secondly, your preparation has to be as good as it was as a player or a coach. You can't just show up and say, I'm Tony Romo, and get in the booth and think that it's going to go well. That has happened many, many times in the world of sports broadcasting when the next big star retires. Do you know that Joe Montana was like, as soon as he retired, he had a broadcasting career?
Really?
You don't know that because it didn't work out. Emmitt Smith's broadcasting career didn't work out so great, right? You can't just be, well, I was the star, so put the red light on, and you have to really commit to it. If you look at who are the biggest long-term career success stories as analysts, they were not the big stars as players. They were guys who dedicated themselves to the craft. What do you know of Chris Collinsworth as a player?
Wide receiver for the Bengals.
Oh, do you remember? Was he a stellar? You don't know how great? Exactly. Okay. What do you know as Kirk Herbstreit as a player?
Nothing at all.
Ohio State.
Okay. What do you know? Now, Todd Blackledge, who's my partner, who's exceptional, considered one of the best in the business, he was a phenomenal college player. He did not have the pro career he expected to have. But it's the guys who dedicate themselves to the craft just as much as they dedicated themselves to, the prep it takes on the field. So if he's willing to do that, he will do well. But he's going to take missteps, and his mechanics are going to be rough because there's no way around it. You have to learn the dance. You have to learn the rhythm. You're about to be a professional that's at the highest level, and you're plying your craft in front of millions of people. When I make a mistake in my job, everybody knows. When I say something the wrong way or take a miss, everybody knows. That's going to happen to Romo now. He's conditioned to that happening, but in a place where he's an expert, throwing a football, avoiding, you know, pressure. Now he's going to do it as a TV analyst. It's a little different when you get on the other side of it because now you have to perform.
And, I mean, for as much as he'll spend the summer preparing, there's always things that happen during a broadcast that you're not ready for, and that's something that has kind of been said of you. It's called the test effect.
Oh, yeah, the crazy finishes, yeah.
That you tend to broadcast some wild games, that right. Chaos happens when you're in the booth, and to me it begs the question, you know, what's the most memorable game you've called?
That's a good question. I can tell you the most memorable 24 hours of broadcasting, because I don't think I'll experience it again. Some years ago, when Oklahoma State was the number two team in the country in college football and they were getting ready to play for the national championship, they were 1 week away from playing in the BCS championship, and they were a 28-point favorite against Iowa State on a Friday night. And I did that game with Rod Gilmore and Sam Ponder, Sam Ponder's first year broadcasting. And she was my sideline reporter that year. And they lost in double overtime in one of the most outrageous games you've ever seen. The number two team in the country with a week to go in the season.
ESPN then flew me the next morning down to Waco, Texas, to do Oklahoma, who was preseason number one, to do Oklahoma against Baylor with RG3 at quarterback. And it was the ABC prime game. And it was the night that RG3 hit a last-second touchdown pass to beat Oklahoma on the ABC prime. So in 24 hours, two of the top teams toppled. They both did it in outrageous fashion. I was doing that game with Matt Millen and Aaron Andrews.
And everybody that whole day was talking about, I can't believe what happened last night, the most outrageous finish to a football game I've ever seen, double overtime, and Iowa State 28-point. And then the next day we did a game that topped it. And it was just, my head was spinning. Absolutely spinning. But I've done some wild ones. I mean, I've done the Penn State-Michigan 4-overtime game. I did the Colin Kaepernick versus undefeated Boise State when they thought they were going to play for the national championship. Double overtime. Two missed chip shot field goals on Thanksgiving. Game that went like 5 hours. I mean, it was ridiculous. I probably can't even remember half of the overtime. I did this past year, I think we had the highest rated game on ABC to start the season, the double overtime Texas Notre Dame.
Yes, I remember that.
Game, which had more outrageous moments in it, a 2-point conversion returned, and you know, I mean, I do a lot of overtime games,
yeah.
But they don't pay me overtime. They still pay me if they. So yeah, it's been a fun ride. Yeah, I've even done some crazy upsets in other sports, like when Zenyatta was the undefeated thoroughbred horse in the Breeders' Cup, and she lost, and she had never lost in her career. I was the broadcaster of that on ABC. So hopefully the roof stays up here. Maybe it's me. I don't know. Maybe wacky things happen. But yeah, it's been fun.
Well, as an alumni of Boston College, obviously their athletics is always in the news, I feel like, around here. So there's a lot of positives and negatives with the current state of the program. But just beyond the wins and the losses, how do you think BC Athletics is doing well, and are there places they can improve?
Well, obviously, there's going to be an athletic director change here. And I think I don't know that, but the coaches here and the players here and those that are part of the support staff, they are all about winning, and they are capable and good coaches and players that can win. What you have to do in any organization is you have to desire to win at every level, from the guy who sweeps up the court all the way through the president of the university and the board of trustees. And you need to give everybody all the support they need to be able to make that happen. So you have to have, you know, I'm blessed to travel around the country, go to a different athletic department every week and see that. And there are some schools where you can actually feel it, that juice and that energy is pulsating through every aspect of the university. I think in the last 5 to 10 years, the landscape of major college sports has changed more than any aspect of my industry there is. How you have to be so fluid and competitive and be able to react at a moment's notice. And the money has gone tenfold, 20-fold, 50-fold, 50 times what it was. And you have to then change the way you approach your business, because you're not dealing with something that is clubby and fits comfortably. It is hyper competitive. And just like any competitive business that's a multi-billion dollar business, and at this level, you have tens of millions of dollars coming through the front door, whether you sell one ticket or not, and the potential for $100 million coming through the front door. You need to react, and you need to already know what your identity is, how you're going to react, and be able to react at a moment's notice. You need to be highly competitive. When I say highly competitive, I'm not talking about Steve Adazio and are we practicing hard enough. I'm saying highly competitive in terms of the marketplace, in terms of coaches' salaries, support staff salaries. If you go down to Tuscaloosa, Alabama, Nick Saban has hallways filled with recent college football head coaches doing nothing but acting as analysts and cutting up film tape and scouting tape. Now, I understand that that doesn't necessarily fit with our ideals, but that's what you're playing against. When you're playing against Florida State, Clemson, and Louisville as in your division, you are playing against those. You are competing against those who are resourcing it to that level. I think this place does an excellent job of having student athletes, coaches, and teams that represent the university incredibly well. Incredibly well. When you meet a BC athlete, or when you look at what ends up in the news at other places, you don't have to have that headache here. That's important. I never want this place embarrassing me or embarrassing itself. It doesn't. I do want this place to always desire to be the best. So when we say ever to excel, to serve others, I may define that differently than other people do. I define ever to excel to serve others as, well, if you're an attorney, if you're an accountant, if you're a hedge fund manager coming out of finance this season, be the best you can possibly be. Make the most money you can possibly make. Be the most accomplished you can make, so that you can then take that energy, those resources, and that wealth and serve everybody else in your life, from your family to your extended family to your alma mater, and that you can push things in the direction you want to push things. And we should always be striving to excel at everything we do. If our motto is ever to excel, that should be, that brushstroke should be painted across everything that Boston College touches. And I think a lot of high academic private universities struggle with that fine balance of identity. Stanford did in 2005 and 6 and 7. And then they said, you know what, we're going to hire Jim Harbaugh and we're going to get this done. Northwestern has struggled with that identity. And then they said, you know what, we're going to call the Ryan family and we're going to get that new facility built and we're going to allow Coach Fitzgerald to press the gas pedal. We have people in place here that we don't need. This doesn't need to be a carousel of coaching hires and fires. We just need to know that we have the handcuffs off and the resources and the freedom to allow the people who are in place and allow the greatness of this university, where people take such pride in it, to be fully blossomed and to really hit the gas pedal and to really be the best it can be. We do that with other elements of our university. If you go down to the BC Wall Street Council dinner in New York every April, you will realize the expanse of BC success stories. But that should be touching upon every aspect of the university. So that's what we do well, is we have really good committed people with a big heart. What we need to do better is make sure every single aspect of the university is on the same page to kick ass and to stay true to what the motto is.
I love the point you made about the student athletes here and the standards they hold themselves to. I found that to be true, and I think you just notice in comparison to athletes at other schools just how well-spoken BC students are, and you know how prideful the university is of that, and
you should be.
Not embarrassing themselves in any way or the program, which is great. I think it's part of a culture here that you touched upon.
It is.
So with the AD search, I mean, some sources or people have said that they think the AD should be someone who's a BC alum, who's part of that culture. I mean, what do you think about that? Do you think
it doesn't have to be a BC alum? It doesn't, you know, you just need to be wired in the same way, and you need to have great respect for what the culture is here. I love the fact that we're a Jesuit university. I love the fact that we have high academic standards. I love the fact that, and this is the difference between BC and most every other university. Whether you're a student athlete here, a student here, whether you're on the dance team or whatever, if you're part of the BC brotherhood and sisterhood, you are taking class, and you are friends with those who are going to be the godparents to your children, are going to be making up your wedding party, are going to be those you call in crisis of life, career life, personal life. They're going to be making up the first 10 pews at your funeral. That is what you're getting here that's different. Well, that matters, and you have to acknowledge and respect that. And that can be used in a positive way. So all the AD has to do here is understand and acknowledge how special of a place it is because of that fraternal feel, that this is more than just a place you go to school, that this becomes your life, that you guys email me, and if I have the opportunity to help you and serve you and spend time with you, I will get in the car and drive here from Connecticut to sit here and do this podcast with you. That's not normal. You understand that, right?
We do.
Okay. That's a BC thing. And an AD who takes the job just has to understand that and use that as a great positive, because he will have people. If he picks up the phone and calls a certain person and needs something accomplished, that will get done because of the care of the legacy, the culture, the brotherhood. So you turn all that into a positive. Doesn't have to be a BC guy, just has to be a guy who acknowledges, recognizes it, and utilizes it.
Well, on a broader scheme of college athletics, yes. I know with the NCAA, obviously, you always hear things like, should athletes be paid, things like that. I just want to get your take on the future. You talk about how hyper-competitive things like college basketball, you just saw the NCAA National Championship for Basketball, how competitive that was. I just want to know, what are your thoughts on thinking about like players getting paid in the future of the NCAA?
I mean, I don't see anybody holding a gun to these players' heads when they sign a letter of intent. Listen, when it comes to the name and likeness issue, I get that. Somebody shouldn't be owning and operating somebody else's name and likeness. But I don't agree with players being paid. Nobody's telling you to come here and sign a national letter of intent and get a $68,000 education and, you know, have wonderful coaching to potentially prepare you for your professional life as an athlete. I think that's less of an issue here at BC. I think it's more of an issue at the games I typically do in Saturday night primetime in the SEC. Mm-hmm. I have a very clear stance on that. Do I acknowledge that in the 4 years Doug Flutie was here, what the alumni development was and how much he brought into the university and what Johnny Manziel did at Texas A&M for a year there, or Cam Newton did at Auburn for a year? Yeah. And if the university wants to have an escrow fund and say, listen, here's, you know, for this team, you're setting this aside, and upon graduation, you're cut in at X when your eligibility is over, God bless. That's wonderful. Should a player probably have his name and likeness to himself? It is him. He is the person. Yes, I understand that. But, no, does the university need to pay them? No, the university is providing them with a wonderful opportunity to be highly educated, to work with first-class coaches. I mean, if I'm an offensive lineman, I have the single greatest developer of NFL offensive line talent. You know, Steve Adazio knows more about coaching the offensive line to prepare you to play in the NFL than any human being on earth. You know, that's pretty good that I would get that for 4 years. I don't agree with that at all. It's amazing how that perspective changes once you become a student athlete and you're 3 years in.
Well, I happen to agree.
Because you were begging for the scholarship prior to that and where you want to, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I think the part that trips me up is something you mentioned. It's the name and likeness issue. You know, how can players or athletes be compensated for the profits the schools are making? But in principle, I agree with you, especially with the existence of so many scholarships. And like you said, the preparation they get from the finest minds in that sports business, I mean, that's invaluable. How they figure out the likeness issue.
Yeah, I mean, I think the one thing I mentioned is in unique cases where we can point to a Johnny Manziel and say, listen, here's what the bookstore brought in selling number two jerseys. Here's what alumni development cashed in on because of your Heisman run. And, you know, but obviously they need to be compensated on the back end. But yeah, that's the only part that really I have an issue with is the name and likeness and image.
Well, in terms of now having a son that's going to be playing at Boston College, is it 2022 the year that he's expected to be graduating? So he should be.
Yeah, he's a 2018. He signs his letter of intent next year.
2018.
Yeah.
Well, that's fantastic. So did he have any other offers he was considering?
Oh, yeah. He traveled around the country and he's blessed. You know, he's part of those showcase camps of the punters and kickers, and so John was, you know, quite blessed, and he had a wonderful, weekend down at UVA and an incredible recruiting visit to Yale. He's wired a little differently now. You know, he was going to use football as his means to go to a college he wanted to go to, and potentially so. We had just gotten back from a trip out to Los Angeles where he was in with, you know, at USC's facilities for a day, and a really tremendous visit there with one coach in particular. And he was, you know, loved his recruitment to Yale and UVA, and but there was nothing. And I tried to be very, very objective here and just let him take his course. He's a talented kid, his first team New England, and a heck of a punter and kicker. But his relationships that he developed here with Coach Addazio and his staff and Coach Leonard and Ricky Brown and his love of this place, it's interesting. It doesn't go unnoticed to me that 2 weeks prior to John's offer and commitment to play football here, he was honored in downtown New Haven for a Community Spirit Award of local parents who nominated him for an award that my wife and I were told to be someplace at a certain time. And I think that that Jesuit mission really bled through to John. And I think that's a really big part of the type of student athlete we get. Somebody that's going to respect the academic workload. Somebody that's going to take to the understanding of service to others. And, oh, by the way, be able to hit a 45-yard field goal 10 times out of 10 times. I think, you know, so we're very proud of him. We're very much looking forward to him being here. It's incredible for, you know, it's amazing what, when John committed. And then, you know, nowadays the recruitment is covered to such an extent. You know, it's on Twitter and social media, and there's articles on blogs and all this stuff. I was getting texts and phone calls from guys who played here during my years, guys I haven't talked to in 10 years, 15. Oh, we're so, this is awesome. This is unbelievable. And guys who I talk to every so often or a text every so often. And, you know, like guys like Pete Mitchell, one of the greatest, you know, text, oh, Tess, this is amazing. We can't wait. So I think it'll be fun for my generation of guys to have John playing here. It'll be a lot of fun.
So he is excited to be a dude under Coach Addazio?
He's thrilled. And he's been coming to practice. You know, since his commitment, he's been coming up here, and I know his mindset is, hey, I'm galvanizing that class of 2018. Like, I want to know who these guys are, and I want to, you know, I want to really get after it with that. So he's been really thrilled to come up here, and I think he was here this, but I was down at Ole Miss this weekend doing some SEC football, but I know John was up here this past Saturday, and he's excited about the direction of the program, and I think he's coming up. I got to go to Alabama next week, but he'll be up. While I'm at Alabama, he'll be up here for the spring game. And he's got great respect for the guys who are currently here. And, you know, Mike Knoll and Grant Carlson and Colton Lichtenberg and those guys. You know, Grant is a guy who he trained with down in Texas a couple of years ago, and now they're both going to be up here, you know, playing at BC. So it's exciting.
That's fantastic. I mean, we're excited to watch John kick here. We hope that he is able to galvanize that class, like you said. That would be
that would be
really exciting.
Let's hope he makes a lot of field goals. How about that?
Yeah, well, hey, we're on board with that too. There's no question about it.
Let's hope I don't get assigned one of the primetime games against Florida State or Clemson, because I don't think I could do it.
I'm sure he'd come through for you with a big kick that day. But Joe, we really look forward to hearing you on the call of many more primetime games. As we said, you're a distinguished alum of the university and of WZBC Sports. You know, you once sat where we sat, and now
yes, very much. I think I bought a piece of equipment that you probably threw out about 20 years ago, like one of the.
It wouldn't be the only old equipment that we have. Yeah. We're making it work for sure. But we're very, you know, honored to have you here, and we really thank you for taking so much time out of your busy
My
schedule
pleasure.
To sit down with us.
My pleasure. You guys do a great job. Keep it up.
Thank you, and I also want to say a quick thank you, Steve Mackley, for setting up this podcast, and he's been on so many of our podcasts this year. As the podcast coordinator, Ryan Short, who, Joe, you communicated with to set this up while you were on campus. Andrew Kelly, for winning the 3-on-3 Hoops versus
Hope
tournament.
That was impressive. That was impressive.
For getting this podcast.
We
got to
get maybe Vital and I can come up and broadcast that next year. That would be,
That would be a huge get, I think. That would be phenomenal. Anyway, Joe, Thanks again.
Thank you, guys. Really, what a pleasure to talk to you. Very, very proud of all of you. So keep pushing forward.
Thank you. This has been episode 21 of the WZBC Sports Podcast. We thank you for listening, and you can keep up with all our content on Twitter and Instagram at WZBC Sports. We're also on Facebook at WZBC Sports 90.3 FM. And, of course, you can hear this podcast on our website, WZBCSports.com, and for free, download it on iTunes. Just search WZBC Sports Radio. Again, episode 21 in the books. Go Eagles.
Santini, make a nice little pass over to Sanford. Sanford gives it to Tuck. Tuck with a shot. Oh! Tuck scores. Eagles win. The Eagles have won the 2016 C-Punt Championship.
Catch all the excitement of Boston College Athletics right here on WZBC Newton 90.3 FM. As BC's only student radio broadcasting organization, WZBC Sports brings a different viewpoint of college athletics to the table. Our student commentators know the campus, student-athlete culture, and latest beat on the teams like no other media outlet, thanks to our dedicated coverage of Boston College sports. Check out our broadcast or weekly talk show schedules at www.wzbcsports.com and get a refreshing take on sporting events at the Heights and beyond.